Many, many people have watched people on stage or screen cracking us up and thought, that looks fun, making people laugh. That could be a really cool job. But then reality sets in. What are the chances any performer makes a living, especially in the comedy business? Today's guest knows the answer. Joe Randazzo wrote a book that is part memoir, but much more a guide for people who think they might want to try their hand at comedy. The book is Funny on Purpose, the definitive guide to an unpredictable career in comedy. Joe Randazzo is the creative director at AdultSwim.com, but that's just one line on his resume. He's also written books and TV pilots, voiced cartoon characters, taught classes, and is a former editor of The Onion. And yes, he's done improv and stand-up comedy, too. Joe, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So this book is by no means all you. You talked to a lot of other people to pull this together. Name some names here.
Yeah, no, I wanted to get, you know, sort of give my own perspective on things, but then back it up with kind of expert testimony. So I tried to pick some of my favorite people in the various genres and fields of comedy. So I started with Jack Handy, who's, you know, kind of a legendary comedy writer. He invented deep thoughts on Saturday Night Live and still writes for The New Yorker and put out his first novel last year. I got Judd Apatow, you know, the famed comedy director, Weird Al, the parody songwriter. Joan Rivers spoke to me, Terry Jones from Monty Python, and then a lot of other people who are working in fields of comedy that those who are maybe interested in those fields would know, but are maybe not so nationally well-known, like the director David Wayne, Tim Heidecker, and Eric Wareheim, Kelly Oxford, who's a great writer, Megan Amram, another great writer, people like that.
We've actually had Megan on the show, but this is a pretty good indication that there are lots of names that are in the business that you may never hear, but people who the other people in the comedy business may revere.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, you know, I sort of, when I was laying out the book, I tried to cover as much about the comedy industry as I could, but wanted to start with the sort of baseline of where the genesis of most comedy comes, and that is writing. You know, and a lot of comedy writers, with a few exceptions, remain somewhat anonymous throughout most of their careers. They're very well known in their industry, you know, but they don't become necessarily household names. I mean, one of the few glaring exceptions to that, I think, would be Larry David, who, you know, started out writing and executive producing Seinfeld and then has kind of gone on to have his own career because he also was a stand-up comedian, really talented performer, so he's sort of one of these guys who could do everything, but for many years he just worked as a writer and was not known outside of the community.
And there's always Conan O'Brien as well, who made the jump from the writer's room to the front of the camera.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
John Hodgman actually wrote the foreword in the book, and he writes that comedy requires a set of skills that historically have been closely guarded by a guild of bitter weirdos. Do you second the motion or have a slightly different take on that?
Well, I think, pardon me, I think that comedy has changed and evolved and expanded a lot, especially in the last decade. You know, for a long time, it had really been dominated kind of by that ilk, or at least that was the sort of front-facing personality of stand-up comedy, you know, this sort of idiosyncratic, slightly antisocial, unconventional alpha male types. But it has gained more and more notoriety and prominence, and as there have been all these different platforms for people to explore, and, you know, YouTube or podcasts or Twitter or what have you, and it's welcomed a lot of different comedy voices, a lot of different kinds of comedy, and I think that that overall sense of the misanthropic weirdo has kind of dissipated over time. It's still very much present, but it's not quite, you know, the paradigm as it once was.
Eric Idle, I saw it at a show years ago, and he said that, you know, most people who do comedy are people who've got problems with their mothers.
Yeah, well, that's definitely the running the running gag. For sure, you know, there's something kind of, and, you know, and I guess when you think about it, you're thinking about mainly stand-up comedy. That's the kind of really pure version of it that I think everybody immediately goes to in their mind's eye. But, you know, there's something kind of, if you think about it, bizarre and perhaps mentally unstable about getting up on stage with mostly complete strangers to stand there while a bright light shines on you and you desperately try to work out the stuff that you cannot for the life of you figure out or are insecure about in your own life in order to make others laugh. That's kind of a weird thing when you break it down. So for a lot of people, I think this is still very much the case. A lot of comedians would have a hard time fitting into society with traditional jobs. You know, they sort of see the world a different way, or there's something that's kind of broken about the world the way they see it. And maybe that stems from something having been broken in themselves. And I think getting up on stage is an act of trying to put that back together to some degree.
You make it sound like therapy, that it's kind of like going to see some, you know, it's like talk therapy, but nobody sits there and goes, uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, ideally it works that you get paid instead of paying somebody else. And it doesn't, you know, you can stretch it out as long as you want and not have to pay any extra. But the only thing is, if, you know, you walk out of your therapist's office generally feeling better, you can walk off stage feeling a lot worse if it doesn't go well.
John Hodgman, you mentioned the various platforms and the many places that are outlets for comedy now that exist in the age of the internet. And so he brings up a good point that every joke you can think of has been made minutes ago. I mean, so there must be that greater degree of difficulty in that sense in the comedy business now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's a kind of continuum and a sort of filtering that happens where, you know, as soon as there's a shared experience, whether it's breaking news of any kind, tragic or, you know, a Beyonce album, or something that's going on that everybody's talking about, could be the Game of Thrones finale or a presidential announcement, you get the sort of bottom feeding happens on Twitter where 4,000 of the same jokes are made. And I think it also creates this effect where people rush to be the first, which I think is a whole separate issue that we can address sometime, but how there's a sort of lack of empathy and caring that happens when people are just rushing to make the first funny comment about it. But then it sort of, in a weird way, trickles down as the day goes by, so that when you get to your Daily Shows and your Conan O'Brien's, which are actually airing, you know, at 11 or midnight, which is an eternity on a day on the internet, they have to try a lot harder than they used to come up with a joke that nobody has made yet.
Huh, okay, so all kinds of pressures there. Much more to talk about with Joe Randazzo. He's the author of Funny on Purpose. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Joe Randazzo. He's a comedy writer and performer, the creative director at AdultSwim.com. He's a former editor at The Onion. He's written a book about his career in comedy and opening the door for other people to consider following him through it. Funny on Purpose is the name of the book, the definitive guide to an unpredictable career in comedy. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. When you talk about the rush to get the first joke out about something, it sounds like TV news in a sense. You know, let's be first. We don't have to be right. Let's just be first.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a really good comparison. Yeah, for sure.
How weird is it trying to make funny stuff, but the business itself is so serious? It sounds like it is really hard on people.
Well, it can be, because every time you're going out there, whether it's submitting a packet to be considered for writing on a TV show, or if you're starting a new podcast or going to your first open mic, you're being judged by others, you know. But that's the very basis of the business. Is if you're just telling yourself jokes in a closet, you know, you can hardly call yourself a comedian. I mean, it's difficult to make money doing that, as far as I know. And I guess that's the goal of what we're kind of talking about. How do you make a career? But it's also what I tried to address in the book. How do you do something that's fulfilling for you? How do you maintain your own integrity? And how do you continue being a good person in this business where it looks like everyone is pitted against themselves? But I can say that most of the places that I've worked, and now I'm actually just recently moved to Los Angeles. I'm the new head writer at this great Comedy Central show called At Midnight. And it's the same here. Every room that I've worked in, every group of people I've worked with, it's gone so much better when it's a supportive group. And I think that has something to do, and this is a little bit inside baseball, but improvisational comedy is very much based on that. Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, two great examples. They've written and talked about it a lot more eloquently than I can, but it's sort of based on the idea of taking what someone gives you, accepting it, and then building it. You know, it's almost a kind of spiritual philosophy, but you kind of have to be more positive. You have to be more supportive in that. And I think over the past decade or so, improv has had a huge influence. It always has in comedy, but especially lately, has had a huge influence on comedy as a whole. And I think people have started to see and realize that there's a lot more productivity to be had when you're doing it in a productive and positive environment than if you're working in a sort of scraping, crawling, negative, every man or woman for his or herself environment. So I think to some degree on a macro level that stuff is starting to work itself out. But each person has to kind of go on their own dark internal journey to figure out how worth it is for them to pursue this career, because there are going to be rejections. The keys are figuring out how to deal with those, figuring out how you adapt to them, and also figuring out who to surround yourself with so that when those rejections come, there are people you can turn to who are going to still value you as a person.
Well, in fact, you list the seven traits of highly successful comedy people. One, self-doubt. Two, excellent procrastination skills. Three, fear of the unknown. Four, laziness. Five, fear of failure. Six, poor planning. And seven, a need to express something to the world. So confident people need not apply. It's a little contradictory, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just, you know, a lot of these books, sort of how-to frameworks for living your life more effectively, I think a lot of them mean really well, and it would certainly be nice as a human being living in a universe of chaos to believe that there is meaning and structure to everything. I don't know if there is. I'm only 37. I'll probably figure that out in my 40s. But I just wanted to address head on the idea that there are these traits that successful people have that the rest of us don't have, or that can be cultivated over time and lead you towards success, and sort of get at the idea that, no, everybody is ultimately really flawed, and most of the best comedy comes out of exploring those flaws and making those flaws work for you. You know, that seventh point is that you sort of have a need to express something to the world. That's a big one, and it's important. You don't want to just, most comedy people don't want to just keep it to themselves. They need to put it out there. But I've done a talk a few times based upon these seven traits, and I've had people come up to me and thank me for saying, like, thank you for saying laziness is okay. Like, but it is. It absolutely is, you know, and I wanna make it clear through this that, like, anybody can do this, but you can't deny that you have these traits. Like, you have to kind of work with them. And the hardest working people I've ever met, without fail, have all secretly felt that they are the laziest person on earth. So they have to work as hard as possible so that no one will ever find out. And I swear to you, this is a common trait that everybody I've talked to, I'm like, this person is a workaholic. Oh God, I'm so lazy. I just don't want anyone to ever know. It's remarkable.
It really is. We're talking to Joe Randazzo about Funny on Purpose, the definitive guide to an unpredictable career in comedy. Let's take a call. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange and Joe Randazzo.
Hi, ha ha ha. I love the title of your book. It's very good.
Thank you.
I called to talk about Carol Burnett. Mm-hmm. I had never heard till today what you said about bad relationships with mothers. I read one of her books years ago, and I believe she lived with her mother and grandmother, kind of a rundown place at first in L.A. And also, what's funny to me is when people try to do my jokes, and they slaughter it, and then they laugh because they think they did a good job and it's funny. And then we start laughing because they're laughing so hard at their own messing up of the joke. They don't realize they messed it up, though. They think they did a good delivery, and that makes it funny.
Huh. It's a point, though, Jeannie, that laughter could be really contagious, which is you're working in the one industry where it's okay to spread things,
yeah,
as opposed to being in medical science.
Yeah, or an Ebola doctor or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think to that second point, you know, there's a reason why, you know, somebody like Jimmy Fallon became really, really popular on Saturday Night Live, besides being an extremely funny person who can do these spot-on impressions. He also kind of showed a vulnerability in that he would break down and laugh at stuff that he found funny while performing. And I think he brings that same quality to his show today, where it's just like he just likes to kind of pal around. You know, like when he finds something funny and starts laughing, people are infected by it. And I think that is a kind of really beautiful quality about comedy, is that it can be as much about the material as the delivery of the material.
That is a good point about Fallon, though, and in fact, one that he very well recognizes himself. I remember him coming back to guest host Saturday Night Live and rattling off a list of sketches he was in and how he messed them all up by laughing out loud.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, I mean, that's not to say that he isn't comedically brilliant in many ways of his own, but it's just that sort of quality where he's letting the audience in on what's so enjoyable about something, and I think he makes it really easy to laugh because of that quality.
He does. So your start, what did Ira Glass and NPR have to do with your career choice?
Well, you know, I had always been a big comedy fan growing up as a kid. You know, my favorite stuff was like Airplane and anything Bill Murray was in. There's also this really limited run of this show called Fernwood Tonight that starred Martin Mull and Fred Willard. Yeah,
if we can't get each other, who can we kid?
Yeah, exactly. America Tonight, I think it was called alternately. There were only maybe four episodes of it, but maybe I saw it on Nick at Night or something, and it's just sort of for people who don't know or remember a sort of fake, awkward talk show. But there's some quality about it that really stuck with me as a youngster. But I always wanted to, and I think this is the first time I said youngster in my life, which means I'm definitely getting old. But I really wanted to work in comedy. But then as I got, you know, into high school and older and started to look at the, specter of the real world approaching, it's sort of beaten into your head throughout school that, you know, you need to go to college to get a degree in something that you can apply practically so that you can buy a home. And I just started thinking about, well, I don't know, what can I do? I had recently got my braces off and saw how much it cost my parents, and I thought, orthodontistry, maybe I'll become an orthodontist. But I have never been good at math or science and find people's mouths weird and creepy, so it seems like it would have been a bad career choice. But I sort of, around that time, also discovered public radio and discovered Ira Glass and thought, well, why don't I go into broadcast journalism, which is what I took at Emerson College in Boston. And this way I can sort of have training in a field and, figure out a way to work my own passion for comedy into a radio career. And I did that and worked for NPR in Boston for a few years and then moved to New York and was unable to get any work at all in radio. So then I did the next best thing, which is I worked for The Apprentice with Donald Trump and spent many, many, many hours.
So much like public radio.
Yeah, exactly like public radio. And I was working 60, 70 hours a week looking at footage of Donald Trump change his mind every 5 minutes and figured out that, you know, there was a clear path that one could follow to make a lot of money in reality TV, but it ultimately, at the end of the day, wasn't. The final product did not make me feel great. You know, it wasn't something that, while I think those shows are all, and especially when I was working on them 10, 12 years ago, really entertaining and interesting shows, but it just wasn't something that I was into personally. So I went and worked, again, the next best thing to public radio or reality TV was I worked at a fruit basket company for my friends who own this place called Manhattan Fruitier. Great fruit baskets. Henry Kissinger was among our clients. but I was there for a while and just starting to feel like, okay, you know, I'm approaching my middle to late 20s, and this isn't really happening yet. So I out of desperation, started taking improv classes at a theater in New York called Magnet Theater. And when I was there, I met some people who worked at The Onion and kind of got in with them, and then one of them left to go to India, and when she left, she had recommended me for the job. I tested for it, and I got it, and that was in 2006. You know, and I've been doing stand-up and improv in the years before that, but, yeah, I've worked consistently in comedy since since then.
Well, that is a great track record. Joe Randazzo is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Funny on Purpose, The Definitive Guide to an Unpredictable Career in Comedy. Join us with observations, questions, comments, 800-838-3760 around the region by email jx@jeffnet.org. The idea of a backup plan in case comedy doesn't work, you appear to reject that.
Well, I think, you know, different people should do what works for them. But one of the, you know, I can only report the evidence. And when I was first putting together the book and researching and interviewing people and pre-interviewing people, I had a list of questions that I would ask everyone. And one of them was, what's the worst advice that you've ever gotten? And most of the time, people said, have a backup plan. Because I think it sounds good on paper, but what it kind of subconsciously communicates to yourself is a lack of faith. And going into comedy, as you know, we've been talking about, is really difficult, especially when you're starting out. You know, and I think today some people maybe have a preconceived idea that comedy is not that hard to make it in. You know, because you see these things of these sort of rare stories of a parody account on Twitter that will. He'll get a book deal and then get a TV deal and then his career is launched. Or these Vine, you know, stars on Vine who have 2 million teenage girl followers.
Right, with 6 seconds of video, yeah.
So far, not many people have made the leap from Twitter to TV or Vine to TV without some intermediary steps, you know, without learning about the medium of TV or learning how to write for TV. So you can blow up on one platform, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to translate to another. But I think it's sort of giving some people the wrong idea that, oh, I can just come up with a, you know, a funny Darth Vader account on Twitter where he reads the poetry of Maya Angelou, and then I'll have a career. And that's a great first step, but there's a lot of other steps that you have to take. But the idea of having a backup plan is that I think some people felt that it just makes the notion of giving up a little bit too easy if you know that there's always the backup plan. Because what that says is, hey, if things get rocky, come on back and, you know, work at the fruit basket company. And that's nice to know and it's nice to have. But I think it's much more important to have around you something I alluded to earlier, which was just a group of people that you can really count on, that you can be inspired by, hopefully who are also working in comedy or pursuing their own sort of difficult creative goals. But rather than just say, well, look, at the first sign of this not working out, I'm going to go work for my dad's office chair company, give yourself a little more time to fail before you decide to get out.
Let's take another call. We have Paul in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joe Randazzo, the author of Funny on Purpose.
Good morning, Joe. I'm on the other end of things, and as Jeff will tell you, from time to time, I can get him to laugh.
Once in a while.
Once in a while. And I'm pushing 60, and I can retire at any time. And I've thought, you know, in terms of career paths after retirement, of any sort of things from working for CASA to goat herding to being a religious or a mystical charlatan of some sort. Mm-hmm. And you're opening up a whole new line of a possible future career. Is there any real opportunity to start cold, you know, in your 60s? And do stand up or do something in comedy?
Wasn't
I have
any
one
young...
other question after mm-hmm. that.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think that's one of the great things about how many different platforms. Forgive me for using that word so much, but I've been working in, you know,
in the
online
media business, yeah.
for years now. Is that not only are there more outlets for individuals to express themselves, there's also more opportunities for audiences and new audiences. I wouldn't just look at it in terms of can I go out there and do stand-up, because that's certainly something that you can do. But think about what you might want to write and what audiences you might want to tap that have not yet been tapped through comedy blogs, or what kind of a podcast you might start that might appeal to, you know, funny religious charlatans over 60. Or maybe you start your own comedy religion, start a podcast for that. There's so many different ways to do it, especially when you're first starting out. I would say stand-up is not the only thing that somebody should consider. Now, you know, it also depends kind of how you define success and how you define a career. You know, one of the guys I interviewed, Michael Kupperman, a brilliant, brilliant cartoonist, says a career is the belief that you have a career. because it is much harder, you know, to be honest. It would be much harder for somebody over 60 or pushing 60 to get staffed on a TV show here in Hollywood. You know, it's just the emphasis is always going to be on younger people. I think white males in their mid-30s to late-30s probably are, you know, take up the highest percentage of writers, but still the emphasis is on younger. But there's so many other ways, from Amazon self-publishing to starting your own podcast to just being funny on Twitter, to at least put your foot in the door. And the key then is developing your voice and finding an audience.
Paul, what was your follow-up?
Well, I think he touched on it. I was going to discuss social media and opportunities there, and I think he did a pretty good job of that. Well, thanks very much. If nothing else, I know I'll have the goats rolling in the field.
Good, right. Good. They're the toughest audience in many ways.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Good to hear from you. Okay, so definitely certainly a skewing younger kind of thing, but that's kind of the deal with the whole American entertainment industry. We'll talk more with Joe Randazzo about what he's done to build his own career. His book is Funny on Purpose, The Definitive Guide to an Unpredictable Career in Comedy. And, of course, in the process, he throws open the door to letting us know how other people can get into the comedy business. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Joe Randazzo and your comments and questions via phone and email in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're getting lessons in how to have a career in comedy. It certainly has worked for Joe Randazzo, and he details his own exploits and how other people can potentially follow him in his book, Funny on Purpose, The Definitive Guide to an Unpredictable Career in Comedy. Joe is now the head writer at Midnight on Comedy Central. You can find that online and watch it on the air as well. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange to talk to Joe at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Bill in Arcata sent an email. He wants to know, is the name The Onion a parody of the phrase the union, as in order to form a more perfect union?
Oh, no, that's a much more advanced reason than I think anybody who came up with it was thinking of. No, it was started in 1988 in Madison, Wisconsin, at the University of Madison. Nobody actually can remember exactly what the onion means, but there's a rumor or urban myth or whatever you might call it within the onion universe that it had something to do with the founder or with the founders having been so poor that they could only afford to eat onion sandwiches. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Whew, not great breath at that office, I'm thinking.
No, still probably not. The breath isn't so great there.
So while we're talking about the Onion, you mentioned having to test for the job at the Onion when you ended up one of the editors there.
Yeah.
How do you test for a job at a place like the Onion?
Well, every job does it a little bit differently. The Onion is a sort of very particular instance where for a lot of years, you know, because it sort of started at the University of Wisconsin and Madison, grew out of that community for a long time. It was just you had to be friends with somebody who worked there already to get in. And it was very informal and very, very embracing of the sort of Generation X idea of like, whatever, you're hired, you can have a job here. So I was one of the first people who joined the Onion who was what was called an outsider, where I didn't really have a direct link to somebody. You know, I had the friend who had worked there who recommended me for the job. So they're a little bit unconventional, but what they did was the editor-in-chief at the time, Scott Dickers, just sent me a rough draft of a story that they wanted to run that needed some work. And he said, here's the story, and I'm trying to remember what it was. It had something to do with a lawnmower, but that's all I can remember. And he said, you know, the jokes aren't really landing. It needs to be a little more from the perspective of the guy and needs to, you know, read a little drier, so see what you can do. And I got a Word document, made my editing changes in blue, and he went over them and then called me about a week later and actually left a voicemail while I was at the fruit basket company, basketing fruit.
Manhattan Fruitier.
At Manhattan Fruitier, great baskets, and said, yeah, I'd like to give you a job.
That's excellent. In fact, the whole first part of the book is about writing comedy, and
yeah.
And obviously because you have to put your ideas down somewhere to get the process rolling. How much did you mention training for broadcast journalism? Did that actually help you being able to write short, punchy sentences?
Yeah, you know, it actually did. I think it trained me to look at what is necessary in a sentence. You know, to sort of organize and actually The Onion, the way they write does sort of mimic in many ways a sort of journalistic style. But it's more based on the print model, you know, kind of like aping a New York Times style than it would be necessarily a broadcast model. But I think, you know, training broadcast journalism, how to write copy for radio really did teach me a lot about kind of like, where do you get the most punch? How do you find good sentence rhythms that sound conversational, and like I said, sort of stripping down to what is the bare essential of a sentence to communicate something.
I love the very premise of the chapter on taste. How big an issue has this gotten in the internet age, when people seem to say just about anything at any time?
I mean, it's huge. It's one of the biggest cultural conversations that's going on right now, because everybody has the ability to broadcast their opinions from their own electronic soapbox. Anybody who prints anything or says anything publicly is up for scrutiny. And everybody seems to feel that they have the exact same right as anybody else to express their opinion. And I can't argue with that. I just happen to think some opinions are better than others. But there's, I think, especially now, a lot of pressure and a lot of hesitation and maybe even fear among comedians that jokes will be misinterpreted or that things they say will cause anger and a sort of lynch mob mentality online. And I think, too, tastes are changing. You know, I mean, this is a time where one of the most extraordinary examples to me is someone like Caitlyn Jenner. The issue of transgender was not even really, you know, and correct me if you disagree, but didn't really seem to be on the cultural radar two years ago. And now we have Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of magazines, and it's just something where automatically, almost overnight, a whole population has had a voice mm-hmm. emerge where it just was not there before. You know, when you think about and cringe at how transgender people would have just been the butts of jokes 2 years ago, and today that just feels wrong for good reason. So tastes are changing, and I think comedians are also feeling that. So they're scared about what they're going to do to deal with that. But at the same time, you know, the internet and social media creates this almost violent echo chamber where emotions run so high. You know, the speed, as quickly as people want to respond with jokes, people also want to respond with their opinion or hatred about something. That's just a very tumultuous time. But I do think comedians have responsibility, whether you're doing stand-up or writing for a satire organization, to not feel that any subject should be off limits, but to just feel like you're being somewhat responsible with your jokes, that you're aiming your jokes at the right target, and that you're, you know, making jokes, not be worried that people are going to be offended, because people are always going to be offended, but if you're going to get up there and put yourself out there publicly, there's probably going to be some scrutiny. So feel like the jokes that you're making are good and that you can defend them if need be.
We have an email here from Jay in Walterville. He wants to know about online humor. He says, if you're trying to do stuff online, do you recommend a podcast or a blog? How do you find your target audiences? Are podcasts best? How do you promote yourself? He's got a bunch of questions there in that realm.
Well, I recommend this book called Funny on Purpose, which covers all this stuff.
I've heard of that book.
Yeah. No, I mean, it depends. I would say most people that I know who are working in comedy are doing all of it. You know, in L.A., everybody has a podcast. Everybody is finding outlets to write online. People are doing stand-up. It's a little bit of kind of everything, you know. You have to be kind of multidisciplinarian. That doesn't sound quite right.
You're right. I'm getting stuck there too.
You have to be a multi-hyphenate. That doesn't mean that everybody has to do everything, but it depends sort of what area you want to pursue. Now, podcasts are great, but if you only do two podcasts, and then the next one takes you 3 weeks to put out, and the next one takes you 6 weeks to put out, it's not worth it. You know, consistency and regularity, whether it comes to doing something for your YouTube channel or putting out podcasts, are almost more important, and I would venture to say more important, especially at first, than even the quality of your content. You know, getting yourself disciplined and teaching your audience, no matter how small it is when you're first beginning, that you will be putting something out every week is more important when you're starting than having the best jokes in the world, because giving yourself that structure and that foundation will allow you to build your voice over time, but you have to do it consistently. So if you want to start a podcast, there's, you know, you have to invest some money, you have to invest some time, and you really have to invest some discipline. So if you're prepared to do that, then go for it. You know, you have to have, I think, a really fresh, interesting angle for your podcast. You have to be able to describe to somebody in one sentence what it is, and it should at least sound like something they haven't heard before. You know, the podcast community is so advanced now that you can't just have two guys sitting around talking anymore. You know, you need to have something more to it. But online, there's also lots of great opportunities to write online. Most of them aren't paid, but at least when you're starting out, it's a great way to, again, build some discipline for yourself, develop your voice, and get your name out there. So it kind of depends what you want to do and what you want to pursue.
How tough is that aspect of regularity? Because when I think about the idea of having to crank out new material each day, each week, and make it funny, I mean, we work here daily, obviously, but we don't have to be funny every day. That's not the point of the show. But to be able to be funny like that, it strikes me almost as those parties where, you know, you meet a funny person and the person next to you says, "I'm going to go get Jane," and they come back and they go, "Okay, be funny."
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the strengths and weaknesses of the internet is that not everything works. You know, maybe 70% of it is actually not that great. Maybe the percentage is even higher. But everybody's consuming so much over the course of a day that it doesn't all have to be great. But the 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 100 things that are really stick out, and that can be enough. But you have to do it a few times. And I think a lot of the, you know, YouTube audiences these days are not necessarily looking for knocked out of the park great comedy material every day, but somebody that they would feel good about watching every day, somebody that they would want to hang out with, per se, and somebody who also kind of reflects back to them like, oh, I could do that too. You know, it's a little bit of a difference on YouTube versus, you know, a stand-up special on HBO. You watch Louis C.K. to marvel at him, at how he can do something that no one else in the world can do. But I think YouTube audiences are looking more for funny versions of themselves or their own peers. So in that sense, it's like having a friend that you can talk to every day. Not everything has to be amazing, but it has to be consistent enough to give people a real sense of your personality. And to have time to build that audience, just sort of mathematically, you need to do it.
You mentioned that the challenge of working in the age of Vine, which, in case any of our listeners haven't experienced it yet, it's a series of 6-second videos, and so people are making really micro mini kinds of movies out there. And you point out that when you got 6 seconds to go, you really got to be funny in like the first second or so.
Yeah,
which leads to the general question of how comedy changes over time. I mean, for example, when you go back and look at Abbott and Costello doing Who's on First Now, is it still funny to you?
I think that's still funny because it's a perfect premise, and it's two people confusing each other. You've got two good, you know, physically opposed people who are just funny to look at, playing with language, which is something that, as long as we're not talking about, you know, Elizabethan England versus current day Chicago, there's not too big of a gap. You can at least understand it, and it's still the comedic timing of it is still perfect. So that's something that I think people would still find funny today. But what Vine is doing is sort of, I think people are just finding new ways to get something across as quickly as possible. And also because it's so short, a lot of it is sort of based on the person's charisma, the person's looks. You know, and this isn't to say that Vine is necessarily more shallow than other media, But, you know, you notice there's a lot more sort of cute boys who are popular on Vine.
Right.
Whereas the, you know, the archetype for the stand-up comedian is not necessarily a cute boy. It's more of a disheveled alcoholic type, you know, at least historically. So it's really changing things, but they're also doing things that are really, really interesting and inventive. How do you get an idea across in 6 seconds, you know? I don't know where it's going to all shake out, but I still do, you know, stand by. It's just because you can be really funny on Vine does not mean that you have enough to support a 30-minute, you know, network sitcom.
I want to talk about the writer's room before we go, because this has always intrigued me. And you talk about the process of writing by yourself and some of the steps you should take, like make your bed, convince yourself that you're organized. But when you get into in a room with other people, I mean, how does that collaborative process work? I mean, everybody comes and brings stuff to the table, and then, I mean, is the sum of the parts greater than the individual parts?
Absolutely. In a good room, that is absolutely the case. And that's why you have rooms. Like, I think they all start with who's leading the room. You know, you need a kind of, this term gets thrown around a lot, but I think it really applies here, a benevolent dictator, somebody who the room trusts and the room is willing to defer to when it's time to actually make a decision, but somebody who will entertain most ideas. You know, one of the things that I think I'm good at is I take an idea and try to expand it and explore it and see where it can be made funnier, give an angle to it that might not have been intended when the writer pitched it, and at least sort of let it float in the room for a minute to see if it takes on any more weight. If it doesn't, then I also know how to kind of let things die. And I think in the room, you know, a good room is kind of like a family. There's going to be dynamics. Sometimes the dynamics are weird. There's going to be people who talk more than others. There's going to be people who are more quiet and subdued. It's just sort of, as a member of the room, finding out where you fit in and where you can best be useful. But the biggest mistake somebody new to a room can make is just start talking and talking and talking. First thing you should do is just listen, listen, listen.
Observe. It's a good thing for a lot of walks of life. So are you a lifer? Are you going to be in the comedy career your whole life, you think? You hope?
Good Lord, that's a tough question. You know, I don't know. I get so much joy out of other things like reading novels and watching horror movies that I'd like to think I could try some of those too. But yeah, I'm a comedian at heart.
All right. The book is called Funny on Purpose, A Definitive Guide to an Unpredictable Career in Comedy. Joe Randazzo, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
Take care.